Welcome to the Historical Gadfly, a podcast devoted to history, current events, good books, and the connections between all three. I'm your host, Timothy Noonan, a graduate student at the University of Oxford. Our email address is historicalgadfly@gmail.com. If you have any questions or suggestions or ideas for future episodes, we'll be glad to hear them. And as always, thanks for tuning in. All right, well, finally we have a pleasant summer day here in Oxford, and I'm really glad to have a very special guest on today's program, which is Avner Offer, who's the current Chicheley Professor of Economic History at All Souls College at Oxford. On today's program, we're going to be interviewing Avner about his current project, which is called From Social Democracy to Market Liberalism, and I'm really glad to have Avner on. So, Avner, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
Great. Well, as is becoming custom on the Historical Gadfly, I'd like to start off just to talk a little bit about your biography and where you came from, and maybe you can try to connect the dots on how your upbringing or childhood may or may not connect with your current intellectual interests. So, as is custom, could you start off by telling us where you were born and raised?
I was born in the British Empire in Mandatory Palestine in 1944, 4 years before the State of Israel was declared. I was born on a kibbutz. Kibbutz is a communal village, communal organization, which comes, I suppose, as close as is humanly possible to complete equality in a modern society. I grew up there, I was educated there, I lived there until about the age of 23. So that experience was powerful in shaping my values and my life experience. Other formative experiences were, my father was a bit of a mover and shaker, so it just happened that I spent substantial parts of my growing up years, well, perhaps not substantial parts, but I spent quite a lot of time overseas. So I spent 2.5 years in North America as a child, in Canada and New York. So I had the advantage of fluent English at a fairly young age. And then in my late teens, I went to the Soviet Union. And I saw the Soviet Union perhaps at its highest point, which is in 1961. I spent 5 months in Moscow. Quite a rich, enjoyable period of growing up. And then 2.5 years of military service, which continued as a reservist for another 7 or 8 years. So the experience of the military and of combat as well. That was also quite a powerful experience. When I finished my national service, although I was still a member of the kibbutz, I started working in conservation. And I worked first in a voluntary organization, NGO, which is a nature protection society in Israel. And then I moved over to their rivals, who are the government agency involved. And I worked for them for 3 or 4 years. And we organized quite a big project, which I won't go into, but which also sated my wanderlust, perhaps once and for all, and gave me quite an insight of how government operates. At that point, I decided that I'd been in the sun for too long and went to university at the ripe old age of 25, started as an undergraduate. This is less unusual in Israel than it is in other places. So I have a kind of 8 years missing where other people have kind of built up academic credits. On the other hand, one of the things I picked up in my scholarship is that people rarely express any regret about their experiences, so I don't regret. Je ne regrette rien. It was all fine. And I went to study history and geography.
We can back up for a little bit.
Yes, okay.
I'd be curious, could you talk a bit about the influence that your mother had on you or kind of the other half of your parents, and also as you were going around the world to North America, Soviet Union, what did you think of these places compared to Israel? And maybe talk a bit about any sense of patriotism or what sort of models in different countries seemed to impress you, or what any specific memories you have of those kinds of experiences.
Well, I think that my second year in North America left quite a powerful residue. Swearing allegiance to the American flag every morning and being brainwashed about the American way of life and the American dream at a very impressionable age, 7 or 8.
Were we living in the country?
In New York City, actually, in Manhattan. It took me about 10 years to get this out of my system. But once I got it out of my system, I think I moved to the other extreme. Mm. I came to the United States from a very poor country at the time, from Palestine. The war was just over, war of 1948. And America was in the midst of the greatest consumer boom ever. In fact, I pay a tribute to this experience in something which appeared subsequently as a chapter in The Challenge of Affluence, which is a chapter on the American motor car of the 1950s. What did I call it? The American automobile frenzy of the 1950s. I was there, and I remember all these cars. You can still see them in Havana.
No, we were just talking about Afghanistan prior to this, and just yesterday looking at some propaganda material produced by Afghan planning agencies from the early 60s, and you see these lines of Cadillacs and so on lined up at gas stations in Kandahar, so very much part of the same modernization thrust.
Yeah, so as I said, I took all of that in and was rather captivated by it in my childish way. And then it was thrust back once again into quite a low standard of living place, although we never felt any kind of deprivation. I think I got a great deal out of growing up on a kibbutz. I thought it was, for me, it was a wonderful experience. I don't know how much I want to say about my mother, except that she was artistic. And in a variety of ways that influenced me a great deal and still influences me today, and I still have that dimension, which has actually appeared 2 or 3 times in my published work, but in the future I have plans to take this further. And I could tell a very interesting story about my mother, which I won't say.
Sure, sure.
The Soviet Union, when I arrived there, we came from the kibbutz. The kibbutz was as wealthy as you can get from doing modern agriculture in the late 50s, early 60s, and dividing the product equally among everyone, which means that on the whole, I suppose we lived at a standard of living that was compared to that of a moderately well-off skilled worker in the city, but not much more than that. And the Soviet Union was not much below that, Moscow, where we lived. And it was summer, and there's a wonderful sense of optimism in the air. And since my father came from Russia, I'd always been interested in Russia and attracted to it. I read a lot of the literature in advance. And I spent a lot of time walking around, traveling around, seeing a great deal of what there was to see. One thing, fortunately, I didn't do, which is to learn the Russian language. Why do I say fortunately? Because had I studied Russian at that time, I would have become a Kremlinologist, and I would probably be out of a job now. I have some of my best friends are criminologists.
Sure.
You know, and some of them fell into that trap, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. way. There's another thing about the Soviet Union. It is a truly ugly society. And I'm glad I didn't have to spend a good chunk, much as I love the Russian people, their literature, and so on, I'm glad I didn't spend my scholarly career mm-hmm. studying that world. Although I think Tim is going to spend...
I think I know what you mean by ugly, but I mean just based on the time that you spent there, can you go into a little bit more detail on that?
This is the aesthetic business. You know, the construction was so poor. There's no aesthetics mm-hmm. there. Although, curiously, you're drawing me into this. I've long had, and I've recently developed more, an interest in socialist realism, which is the main, you know, the main sure. art movement there. Mm-hmm. And again, things move in a curious way, because my great interest in the history of art is late 19th century, I suppose you could call it domestic painting, which is both mostly out of doors but also in the home. I call this the long afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Impressionists are part of this story, but actually only a small part, and they're part of a much larger movement. And this movement was killed by modernism around 1910.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Soviet Union, they didn't hear about this, so they continued to do the same stuff into the 60s or 70s. In some of it, in quite an accomplished way, and it also it tells you very interesting things about the Soviet Union because mm-hmm. it's figurative and so on. So, how did I get there? Oh, yes, we're talking about...
Talking about Soviet Union as an ugly society, but...
Yes, it's also full of lies, you know. It was just a country where everything is a lie. There was a counterpart to this, which is that although there wasn't much of a civil society, there's a lot of intimacy
mm-hmm.
and high-quality intimacy, friendship, and so on, although you never knew whether your bosom friend was not an informer or a spy. So what can one make of that century of communism? I think it's an absolutely... Actually, this brings us to policy norms,
sure.
mm-hmm. actually. And the policy norms was that these people felt the weight of historical necessity on their shoulders
mm-hmm.
and would not let anything stand in their way. But they had no clue as to the intensity and extent of human devilishness, evil, you know. So they intended to force themselves on a backward society, but their leaders or their henchmen forced themselves on them, and while they were quite willing to break eggs and let chips fly and so on, they were themselves the victims of that same... this is the irony of history. They're themselves the victim of that very same logic. It's interesting. I'm reading just now, and I recommend this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading the letters of Boris Pasternak, who was the Soviet Union's greatest poet, to his parents, who had all emigrated.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, their family lives in Oxford, so there's an interesting connection here. And in general, it's not usual that you have an opportunity to read a sustained correspondence from within a country like the Soviet Union. And Boris Pasternak was a person who had a great soul,
mm-hmm.
I think. And so to read a great soul expressing themselves in that context and saying whatever they could say,
sure.
despite the censorship, is quite an experience. But as I say, it's a country with great resources of humanity and culture, which found itself in the most devilish prison, really. And this clash sometimes, you know, the human spirit sometimes continues to bubble up in this context. But still, it's a phenomenon of monumental ugliness. And I'm afraid to say that I feel similar uglinesses creeping up on us. History is playing its tricks once again. And the world of freedom and democracy is also capable of throwing up ugliness of this kind.
Well, I certainly know what you mean by some of the feeling of ugliness, but also with the intimacy. I think there's nowhere like Russia that I've been to where on the street you can feel sort of surrounded and completely anonymous and almost in danger, but as soon as you come into someone's home, very strong sense of sort of I've made it or survived. But I guess to sort of continue with some of the...
Let me say something. Since the Russians were nationalists, the communists were nationalists on the whole, Russian nationalists, the one thing they chose not to suppress was the cultural legacy. So although you couldn't write freely in the Soviet Union, you couldn't express yourself freely, there's nothing to prevent you from reading the classics of the past, from hearing the music of the past, from doing science, from doing... And the other thing is that, you know, when I ask myself, how did this place work, really? And I think to myself, it's a bit like war. In wartime, say a military commander is under strict hierarchical discipline, facing risks both ahead of him and behind. Nevertheless, it is possible for people in that position to exercise their initiative, their imagination. And I think that life in the Soviet Russia to some extent was like that. It's an environment of heightened risk. And what happens if you misstep is that you lose your head. But nevertheless, people were pushing the boundaries all the time in a whole range of areas. And, you know, the system, in a sense, stifled a lot of that. But there's a lot that was interesting and positive that was created. And in some areas, they had world-beating achievements.
Sure. So, better or worse, you don't go down the road of Sovietology, even though it sounds like, at least until... could have had an excellent career, but one... So you instead... well, at that point, I mean, it's interesting because you talk about having this non-traditional, let's say, academic approach for the first 25 years of your life. After that, how does one figure out, here's what I want to do, or here are some of the directions that interest me most?
Well, it was clear to me that I had to. By the way, that is also, it's an interesting point in time where, say, 10 years before, I probably might not have gone to university, but the circumstances were such that I thought it was a reasonable thing to do. I won't go into the details of how I managed it, because it wasn't I already had a family, I had a wife, I had a child, but, you know, it was managed. And I chose to study history and geography. Geography because I thought I might go on working for these nature reserves people, and that would be a good academic grounding. In fact, I did go on working for them. At any rate, they continued to pay me. This is the important thing. History. The reason I wanted to study history is I felt we should remember the time. This is the period in Israel between the 67 war and the Yom Kippur war. And the country is already heading into a kind of dead end, which it's still stuck in. And I felt the need to open a window to the big world. And I thought history was probably the best way of doing this. So I studied history. It was a very old-fashioned sort of history. It was really a German, an interwar German university, which had been transplanted in the Middle East, at any rate, the history department. Quite strong on political culturally, the old style cultural history and so on. A lot of it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I think the thing that influenced me most was geography was quite useful as an introduction to social science, so I picked up a bit of quantitative methods, you know, a bit of economics, things of that sort. Probably the thing that influenced me most was a course I took in the philosophy of science. And I decided to become a historian of science at that stage. I had a lot of encouragement. And I wrote a kind of master's thesis on Darwin, where I make points which I think are still not made in the literature. I won't go into that. But in the course of doing this, I realized that I had two disadvantages. One was that I was not actually a natural scientist myself, not even in biology, and that was a serious handicap. And the other is learning what I learned about Darwin. I realized that this is going to be a very crowded area. And so it turned out to be. So again, I decided to leave that alone. And then I got these scholarships to... Actually, I got scholarships to go everywhere. So I could have gone to the States, and I could have gone to Cambridge, and but I decided to go to Oxford. When I decided to go to Oxford, I didn't go to the States because I wanted to study the British Empire. I think it might have been those first 4 years when, as I said, I was born in the British Empire, so I thought I owed myself a debt to find out what this is all about. I didn't go to Cambridge because for some reason although they accepted me and gave me a scholarship and so on, they thought I was a philosopher for some reason, and they wanted to see examples of my work in philosophy. It wasn't any. So even if I preferred Cambridge, I went to Oxford in the end. Perhaps I should say something about the work I've done over the years.
Right, because it sounds like we've figured out that Sovietology is not the right direction in history science, or at least studying Darwin in context.
That wasn't it either. What I was really interested in... Oh, yes, I should mention something else. I was also exposed to behavioral economics very, very early, because Kahneman and Tversky were both, of course, Israelis. And although I like to say that I heard a course with Kahneman, since this is an official record, perhaps I should come clean and say that it wasn't Kahneman. It was one of his students who was called, I don't even remember his name. He actually was a very good psychologist, but he had studied with Kahneman. Kahneman was around, and so his spirit was hovering over the place.
Sure.
So I was exposed to experimental economics at the point where it was being formulated. You know, just at the time, 1972.
Yeah.
The classic article in Science appeared, 71 maybe, or 72. You know, so this was enormously exciting. I thought I'd do a social history of... There's something I did in geography on the aesthetic side. I wrote a dissertation on landscape as a value. So this related to the nature reserves, but also to my interest in aesthetics and to my interest in the environment and things of that sort.
Yes.
And that gave me enormous amount of satisfaction. I have to say that I look back, the university system in Israel wasn't bad, actually. And it stressed independent work by the students. So, if you wanted to, I think I wrote 4 or 5 quite substantial, you know, 10,000-15,000 words pieces of work, each one of which I found as challenging and interesting as the stuff I've done later.
Yeah.
And one or two of them, you know, might have actually been published or publishable. In fact, I did take and publish a few bits from them. So, landscape as a value, and then I was exposed to the tradition of English landscape design, which I'm afraid is probably the greatest British contribution to visual culture. And I say I'm afraid that's unfair because it is a wonderful contribution. And I thought I'd study English Landed Society. And I had wonderful anthropological, behavioral, all right. sorts of wonderful ideas on how I do this. Philosophy of science, you know, all sorts of highly original ideas, which were quashed as soon as I arrived in Oxford right. and discovered an extremely conventional history faculty, mm-hmm. you know, which has remained conventional
yeah.
ever since. I had a bit of a struggle finding a supervisor, and fortunately, I won't go into the details, but I finally got myself probably the best possible person for this, who was not an Oxford. Mm-hmm. His name is Michael Thompson. He wrote a wonderful book called English Landed Society in the 19th Century, which is not perhaps as trendy voguish as I might have done it, but it was much better than anything I could do because right. he had seen that world from the inside. He understood it from the inside. He's a marvelous scholar, one of the great mm-hmm. British historians. And that association lasted for 15, 20 years. So I started writing about, that's how they thought I was a philosopher. So when I applied to study in all of these places, first I thought I'd study social Darwinism. I think that was the original
yeah. purpose.
Then I said I'd write about the land question. I thought this was a philosophical thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came here and started to do research, I realized that it was economic, it was legal, it was political. There was a cultural dimension to it, but not very important.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a thesis on the land question. It's called Popular Politics.
But that seems to sort of account for part of the shift from art history, or a greater focus on aesthetics to institutions.
Well, there is an aesthetic chapter in that book, mm-hmm. and it's the one I like best. So, you know, there's a strand there which I've never really entirely, and I regard myself as an artist, basically. I don't tell anyone that. But,
I'll edit that part out.
But perhaps I should say something about my historical project. I've done a small number of fairly large projects.
Mm-hmm.
That is the influence of the German tradition in which I was raised, in which the culmination of historical scholarship is a very fat book.
Yes.
So that has always been my ideal, except that I've been influenced by the British tradition
mm-hmm.
to aspire for a thin book, and the result is usually a medium-sized book of some kind. And each of these big projects has been motivated by an existential problem which I need to sort out.
Mm-hmm.
The first book was motivated by my experience of growing up in the countryside, in a communal society, in agriculture, mm-hmm. and so on. And the Nature Reserve Authority, that's another part of the story. So I thought that's a way of sorting this out.
Yeah.
What turned out is that the problem was completely different from what I thought it was. And in the process of grappling with it and getting on top of it, I turned myself into a social and economic historian. Also, one of the things about studying, I have to say there's another thing, that as good as our secondary education was,
mm-hmm.
one reason it was so good was that it was not geared towards examinations.
Right.
So in fact I finished school and I wasn't qualified to go to university. So I spent, that's one reason I went to university later, because I had to do six or seven pretty tough examinations. And I won't say I was completely unprepared for them, but
yeah.
I was working full-time and I was doing
sure.
this. Yes. My results in these examinations were not earth-shaking. They're okay, you know, they're medium, well, they're medium class, but they weren't earth-shaking. So you go to university and you don't really know how good you are.
Right.
But it didn't take me a long time to realize that I was doing what they wanted and doing it rather well.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of smoothed the way. I got a junior research fellowship, I think 2 years into my DPhil here.
Yeah.
And I deliberately took a whole year off from my doctorate, in which I did two things. I studied economics,
mm-hmm.
and I studied German.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought I might want to do some research on Germany.
Right.
And again, both of these decisions have served me, subsequently served me very, very well. So I finished this, I spent a long time doing this doctorate. Again, as far as I won scholarships to go to Britain, I won a scholarship here in Britain. So
yeah.
I was performing quite well compared to what the standards, what the ordinary
sure.
standard was. And then I had the problem whether to go back to Israel or not.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that the Yom Kippur War broke out about 2 weeks after I arrived here. And I went back there. So I spent the first term on the banks of the Suez Canal. And at some moments of anxiety. Let me tell you a little story.
Sure.
I just spent 2 weeks in Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
And while walking up the steps of the Hoover Institution, who is coming down the steps but Henry Kissinger? I wanted to grab him by the hand and say to him, Henry, thank you for saving my life, because while I was there on the Suez Canal and planning for some ill-thought-out offensive action, Henry Kissinger managed to persuade the generals to stop shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And the next bout of shooting didn't strike me as terribly sensible. So at that point, I felt a great deal of gratitude to him.
Right.
Okay. So when
did the choice about whether to stay in the UK or go back to Israel?
Yeah. So I thought Israel was on the wrong track.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that the choice that was facing me was that the thing about Israel is that for someone of my age and my generation, there's no option of passivity, because I was obliged to do military service. So I could refuse to do military service. Mm-hmm. That would make me into a dissenter. Might even have consequences. I don't think the consequences would have been horrendous, but I've been quite marginal. And then I had to judge what were the chances of being effective there in that role.
Yeah.
And the way I rationalized it to myself was that the costs, the personal costs to myself, were not worth the very low chance that I'd be able to have any effect. I'd known that the sort of people I supported barely managed to get one member of parliament
yeah.
in a proportional representation system. So that was quite a hard decision. Something I haven't mentioned is that before that I made a decision to leave the kibbutz. I should say the decision to leave the kibbutz was more difficult than the decision to leave the country.
Just, I think that, I mean, I don't know this, and I have to imagine that, I mean, because this is just such a different world from the sort of one I know, when, I mean, is when you're leaving a kibbutz, is that like a formal process where you're sort of retiring from it? Talk a little bit about how that...
Well, you just say that you're leaving.
Okay, yeah.
The kibbutz is open exit, open entry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not so much open entry. There's a certain amount of sifting and so on. But at that time, you didn't get anything. Nowadays, you get a bit of compensation.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't worry about that because I had nothing in the world anyway. You know, I was 23 years old or
mm-hmm.
something like that. But essentially, I'd been quite strongly committed to the values. Actually, I can tell you why. I don't think I'll get to talk very much about my current research.
It's fun. I mean, in some ways, I think
it's more interesting.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the important things is to hopefully get some sense of kind of the intellect. Well,
yeah. We haven't even reached that, but I'd actually analyzed. I was quite strongly committed to the values there. I thought it worked reasonably well, which it did. You know, these kibbutzim are still there. And at that time, they had, I don't know, 4% of the population of the country. But they were agricultural, and they're just transforming themselves into industry, but medium-sized industry, small-scale medium-sized industry. And I had quite strong intellectual appetites. Perhaps I should say, I wrote a book about my first experience of war, the Six-Day War, which was not published for various reasons, and it wasn't terribly good either. But nevertheless, you know, I had this appetite to do things. And I looked at that economy and I said, this is not going to work because the basic units were too small and they did not allow a serious division of labor. So you had to work in whatever the kibbutz economy offered. And I did have aspirations to work at, I didn't quite know at what level, but at a level that transcended that. And that was the decision to leave. And again, the circumstance, I was fortunate that although I didn't have a penny and I had a family, the circumstances did allow me to study. Okay, so I left the, so at that point I decided to leave the country.
Right.
Because I thought the policy was futile, it would lead to further bloodshed, further violence, and I'm afraid I've been completely borne out. Things haven't been as catastrophic as I thought they might be at some stage, but they haven't been good. And I think that decision has been completely vindicated. I'm very sorry to say that. I left behind my language, I left behind, I can't say I left behind my culture because I'm quite strongly attached to it. In a variety of ways, which I won't go into it, even creatively to some extent. But it was quite a big range, and even more so for my poor wife. We had to make a similar decision, whether to stick with me or to go back. And I immediately got a job. Although I had a pretty good job waiting for me in Israel, I immediately got a job in the UK, which was in the north of England, in the University of York. Now, I have to say, the north of England had never figured on any of my life plans. And that was, in some ways, an alien and alienating experience. It was my first academic job. There's some very good people there, Charles Feinstein, who I worked with for many years, both in New York and in Oxford. A great figure. I've written a memoir about him, which I enjoyed writing. And I was teaching economic and social history. That was, I could have gone in several directions when I finished. I could have become a conventional historian. I could have become a political scientist, I could have become a sociologist, you know, the thesis allowed me to. So, this was the first reasonable job that came up, that, and I got it, and that kind of determined my future, where I'd become an economic historian, rather than other things I could be. Although, I have to say that, looking at myself now, I'm breaking back into that condition of disciplinary indeterminacy. Now that I'm being released, you didn't mention this, I'm being released from my professorship here. I no longer have to define myself as an economic historian, so I've become a general kind of intellectual and social science.
And I guess, well, we may have to let you go for your further obligations, but I guess the question to talk about maybe throughout this period, and maybe try to, in a few minutes, connect this with some of the concerns of the present work was, this is all, of course, the 1970s UK, which has, of course, been...
this is very important, actually. So
talk a little bit about, you know, did you, at the time, did you get the sense that something was changing?
Well, the UK was gripped with a tremendous anxiety, declinist anxiety. The economy was doing poorly, inflation, foreign competition, the pound was weakening, crisis this, crisis that. I didn't see it that way at all. My narrative, my story at the time was that something quite different was going on. The general thrust of public discourse at the time was that it was these bloody-minded trade unionists which were dragging the country down. I could see two things which are related. One was that coming from Israel, which is a slightly disorderly sort of place, but it's a sort of place where everyone is looking for a better way to do things. There's this kind of get up and go sense, and a refusal to accept the way things are. Many English institutions struck me as being strongly bound by tradition. In some places this is wonderful. Oxford struck me as just being wonderful, a really intellectual and social paradise, and except for the history department, which I thought was a disgrace. But all this talk about decline and so on struck me that there's a general condescension towards the world of production, the world of work, towards trade in general, and within that world, towards manual workers, which I found disgraceful. And the other thing is that it struck me that all these trade unions were trying to do is to claim a slightly larger part of a cake. I didn't see anything. I didn't see anything illegitimate about this. Mm-hmm. But all the talk was that these people were rising above their station. And to this day, I find it difficult to understand. Now, so the idea was that inflation was being driven by wage claims. Now, if you look at the distribution of income, if you look at the income side of the national accounts, well, at that time, 60 or 70%, the labor share was 60 or 70%, but within that labor share, manual workers were only getting half of that. You know, most of the rest was going to the middle classes and the professional classes, just as now the labor share includes the incomes of chief executives. Right. So no one was saying the middle classes were grasping. I was already an academic because I had this junior research fellowship. It was a proper academic post, and I could see trade unionists, this is completely legitimate. Yeah. If my pay was rising automatically by 7 or 8% every year, no one mentioned that. And it struck me as really quite barbaric, and I have to say, these attitudes still persist now.
Well, a lot of the, I mean, some of the features of the rhetoric you're describing seem, at least to me, to echo very clearly in what we talk about public school teachers or in public employees in the United States
right.
today.
Oh, yes, exactly the same story. And so this combination of disdain towards these people, which is really quite close to, I always thought was the relation between the classes in this country smacks a bit of apartheid. And I've never really, it's not that I actually find working class culture all that attractive. I think it's Philistine and Arab. I've actually written about this in several places. So I've engaged with these types of issues. But I've always felt that I stood apart from British society. I couldn't really enter into their way of looking at things. Mm-hmm. And for a scholar, that can be an advantage if you're looking for your independent point of view. So I did that. With that book on randomership. I was playing it by ear. Now, although the book was completed and it was well reviewed and so on, but I never felt I was in complete command of my materials there.
Yeah.
I have a pretty good ear, I think, so ear-wise it went well. And that's pretty much the British style anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel that I'd done everything that I could do with it, with that material. In retrospect, I think that book has held up rather well. It's just been reprinted and, mm-hmm. and so on. And I don't think anything has appeared in that field, which has kind of displaced it. So that was that. I set out to probe my kind of agrarian origins and didn't manage to find them. So the next thing, this is the height of the Cold War
mm-hmm.
and the missile standoff and all of that.
Sure.
I became quite interested in that issue and I decided to write about the First World War. And yeah, the way I got into this was, this is the way I like to tell it. So I went to the public record office and ordered some files.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a file which looked vaguely interesting, which I ordered. It came out in a big box. So I opened this box, this enormous bundle of papers,
yeah.
tied up in string. I untied the string. And this is a big pile of printed material on blue paper. That's what they're called, blue books, mm-hmm. by the way. Printed on blue paper. And this was a report by a commission of inquiry, which I had not known about, which is secret actually, which outlined in considerable detail the arrangements for economic warfare with Germany once the war was going to break out. So these papers were, the committee was in 1911, I think, as mm-hmm. well, but lots of paper. And as soon as I opened this bundle, my hands began to tremble. As I saw, no one told me about this. This thing should not exist. You know? And I suppose it all started trying to make sense of this document. This turned out to be an extremely fertile
mm-hmm.
hunch. So I spent the next 10 years writing, you know, 7 or 8 years, writing this book about the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
An agrarian interpretation, so that's a link into
yep.
the previous stuff. Again, I had a hunch that food was going to be very important. And I can say that I felt a great deal of satisfaction with that book. When I finished it, I thought to myself, what can I do after this?
Throughout the, I mean, maybe as you were engaged in that project, what was kind of the ambition animating that? I mean, I remember speaking with Robin Briggs a couple of weeks ago, and he spoke about, at least at a younger age, this ambition to be like the great historian. I mean, after you've completed the first book, what do you think was kind of getting you to wake up, and how was that stoked as you're writing the second book?
Well, you have to remember, I was at the University of York. I once said to somebody, after I'd been there for a few years, I found myself, I adjusted to living there.
Mm-hmm.
I even said to somebody, I'm reconciled to dying here. but fate would not have it that way. So, in fact, I went to Australia for 3 years.
Mm.
So, once again, there was a great world opened to me.
Yep.
When I was in Australia, I did 3 round-the-world trips. And I stopped at various places on the way and spent quite a long time in Germany and in the United States, and
mm-hmm.
you know, so that was a great experience. I just wanted to find out, and also I thought of this, you know, I think for a modern historian, I was actually trained in the disciplines of medieval history,
mm-hmm.
where every word counts, but in modern history this is a joke. You know, the quantity of evidence is enormous. Nevertheless, I always kept a bit of that
mm-hmm.
discipline. And so there's this massive amount of material and information, both archival and published in several languages from across the whole world.
Sure.
And the challenge was to distill this into a compelling story. At the level of texture, I felt a bit like an artist, mm-hmm. crafting the story paragraph by paragraph. And I think these books have a kind of readable quality which arises from that. People do comment on that, mm-hmm. although they are serious scholarly exercises.
Right.
The other thing is, from the start, I've had this sense that there's a truth that you could get at. It might not be the only truth, but it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And that not to be diverted by relativism. So there's always been the push to get to the bottom of things.
Yeah.
So get to the bottom of things and construct something coherent out of that. And I think I've come closest to that with that book about the First World War.
Uh-huh.
Although the final clinching chapter evaded me. I only wrote it 4 or 5 years after I finished the book. This is the kind of arch stuff, which I didn't quite see how to do it. And it only came to me 4 or 5 years later. So I published this as a separate article. Even while I was in Australia, I had this... England was going through the upheavals of Thatcherism.
Sure.
For a kibbutznik like myself, this is complete anathema.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't really understand why. So I'd done my Samuelson, you know, I'd done my Economics 101. I'd pretty much internalized a lot of that. And this is the decade of greed is good.
Sure.
And there's nothing in economic theory which said greed isn't good. In fact, economic theory says greed is good. But my whole being revolted against this, and so I regarded this as a puzzle. And if the slogan was greed is good, my response to this was that the thing that was good was not greed. But what is it that is good?
Right. Yeah.
And so that started me on this research into well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And fairly early on, I got into a trope which is still very important in my work today, which is the conflict between the present and the future.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of hit on that as the key issue. That basically... greed is a form of impatience, a form of even addiction, a form of excessive appetite and so on, and that well-being is not about satisfying immediate desires. It's about balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So I had that idea and I didn't know what to do with it. And again, I was fortunate I had this year, almost a year in the States in the early 90s. And I was just hitting my head against a brick wall.
Yeah.
And then a book came out in 92 which solved this problem. Other people, by the way, were doing the same thing.
Sure.
And what is interesting is that the solution had been lying around for 25, 30 years, but no one connected things. And suddenly it emerged at the moment where I needed it.
What was the solution?
Well, the solution is time inconsistency. It's the theory of time inconsistency, which, you know, is
right.
It has antecedents. I won't go into this, but it offered the model that I could work with. And so I spent the next 15 years working at this the way I'd been conditioned to by my engagement with economic history.
Mm-hmm.
Which is to do fairly deep empirical work in the context of a theoretical framework. And I thought this would be compelling. And then I published the work on the way.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yes, quite early on, I got this job in Oxford.
Right.
So once again, I think I had good intuitions as to what were interesting questions and was able to produce scholarly stuff that presented this credibly. So in fact, I was already doing this work when the Oxford job came up.
Right.
The two Oxford jobs, I didn't get the first one, fortunately, because it was the less good job. I got the second one, which was the better job. And Charles, who had been my professor at York, had mm-hmm. moved to Oxford, so you know, maybe
right.
this couldn't have been a disadvantage.
Right. And I guess maybe to sort of close this panorama out, but also to give a sense of where your current work is headed, maybe talk a little bit about the current project. And I remember, just as I was waiting here to meet you, I was talking with a porter of All Souls, who was asking me what would happen with the U.S. default, and so on. We talked a bit about, I'm not sure if pessimism would be the right term for it, but maybe talk a little bit about where sort of we're coming from and maybe where you see norms.
Okay. This work culminated in this book, which was published in 2006, The Challenge of Affluence, which expresses the basic idea which I started this episode,
yeah.
which is that affluence in itself is not a worthy end, and there's something else. So, affluence is a good thing,
mm-hmm.
but affluence in itself, or choice in itself, is not sufficient to live a good and decent life. And implicit in that was that those who said that it was were leading us astray. So really, ever since the rise of Thatcherism, I took a dislike to this movement, but I needed to work out a credible argument as to why I disliked it, especially since I had quite a strong commitment to the economic way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And that took me quite a long time. And I think you experience the early results of this in this course,
mm-hmm.
From social democracy to market liberalism. So social democracy for me is a way that in which people, ordinary people, use the state to protect themselves against conditions of dependency which occur in the life cycle. This is quite a long way from the socialism in which I've been raised,
yeah.
Which has some attractions and some non-attractions. There's another thing which has almost completely disappeared, which is the tradition of the youth movement, is a kind of positive idealism of the age of ideology, which in other forms, you know, Bolshevism, you know, in Europe this is quite strong,
yeah.
and for me this is a powerful formative experience. So I increasingly formed the conviction that these doctrines had a dark side. And were perhaps harmful at the individual level. So for a man with aspirations to culture, with aspirations to decency, and so on and so
yeah.
forth, there's something wrong about them. And I put in a proposal, but I also had a sense, by the mid-first decade, that the springtime was over,
yeah.
and that this stuff was beginning to run into trouble, which I found encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that the next episode would be to go deeper into this, and I set out a big program,
yep.
which again won quite a big grant. And what I said there is that this thing doesn't strike me as sustainable for reasons A, B, C.
Mm-hmm.
However, this statement was, I have to confess, pretty academic. I didn't actually expect it to be vindicated so quickly. I've come increasingly to the view that what I call obvious, what are policy norms? Policy norms
This is kind of one of the methodological approaches that undergirds a lot of this project.
Yes. So again, this is a the story. When I started thinking about this, I thought this is the biggest historiographical hole.
Yeah.
How did this machine take over our lives? Market liberals, market doctrines, all of that sort of stuff. And when I started thinking about it, I didn't see anyone thinking about this as a, very much as a, that is unfair. Another thing I said, if I'm thinking about this, there must be 1,000 other people thinking about this, and their work started appearing before mine and so on. I came increasingly to the view that what policy norms? Policy norms are when policymakers have to make decisions, they have a set of beliefs, conventions, convictions, ways of doing things, which are shortcuts, which tell them what they need to do.
So an example of a policy norm is that markets are more efficient than...
Yes, markets are more efficient than bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Very simple thing. So the policy norm then is that if we have to provide for security in our old age, let us do this through financial markets rather than through a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. Let us do it through investment rather than through taxation. These are policy norms. I increasingly came to the conclusion that, now these policy norms are not theory, but they derive their conviction or their credibility to some extent from a body of thinking, a body of theory. And I'd long ago reached the conclusion that the theory does not actually provide the support for the policies that are carried out on its behalf. That, in fact, there's a void in the middle of this theory. Very simply, the idea, the core idea is first that people are only interested in themselves.
Yeah.
And the second is that if everyone pursues their own self-interest, that is conducive to the common good. Now, you can drill down to bedrock, and you find that this has never been proven. Mm-hmm. Neither of these propositions has been proven. So the whole thing has feet of clay.
I think that I remember we talked about in the course that, for me, was one of the most interesting parts and ties in with this, is how do you... Are policy norms something that are disproven, or are they debunked, or how do they die?
Well, they die because they fail. You know, the Soviets had a set of policy norms, and then one day the people who run this society decided that society is not performing, so they shifted to the other side.
Talking about the current project or investigating this history, who? What constitutes failure? Who decides when they have failed?
Well, I think that the financial crisis of 2008-09 is as blatant an example of failure as you would need. I have to say that the owners of the norms have not conceded that yet. But my basic position has been for quite a while that if we take the theory as, and this is my philosophy of science background, if you take that as a theory which is tested in some sense for its fit with reality, then it is simply bad theory. Really bad theory. It has all sorts of other advantages. And I don't think that some of the alternatives are more appetizing. Mm-hmm. So Soviet centralism is by no means, but I think that social democracy, where it's been allowed to work, is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go to Scandinavia, all the small countries in Europe are social democratic. They're the best place on earth in terms of socioeconomic indicators and so on, and quality and dignity and income, and you know, all of the education, everything you look for, health.
Mm-hmm.
They're the best places. We've had this financial crash, which is a vindication, which came far earlier than I ever thought it would. I didn't think it was as closer it has. This is a crisis which has not been resolved. What is more, the owners of the Norns have not changed their minds. Everyone is digging deeper into the holes that they find themselves. But in addition, I've become aware of another issue. So originally I thought this is all really a business of how we conceptualize the process of social cooperation, market doctrines. Markets have their uses. Markets are very good for delivering variety of goods and services for immediate consumption. They're not good over the long run. And they're not good for other things. And for some things they're actually pretty bad. I thought that this is really a clash about both the understanding of society and how to implement that understanding. So that's where the policy norms come. Since then, I've become increasingly aware of a mounting ecological crisis. And that ecological crisis, first, I became aware of the climate change issue. And you don't need to be a genius to see these things, but now I'm much more concerned about energy. So I think energy is, and resources in general, this energy crunch is itself a consequence of the unbridled quest for satisfying appetites, as for the pursuit of growth, the pursuit of competition, and all of that. So it's not separate, but it's another crisis which has come upon us much faster than I think I expected when I started writing about this. And so my mood has changed quite drastically when I thought, well, here I am, a kind of dissenter making interesting intellectual points. But, you know, it's a bit like the old Soviet Union. No one thought the Soviet Union would collapse.
Right, I mean, it sounds like you're working on this project and then all of a sudden you have this delusion of autumn 2008.
Yes, that I'm falling behind history. Now, history is moving faster than my research. And so I'm in a quite apocalyptic mood. But I think I've run out of time because my guests are arriving in 5 minutes. I have just enough time to change.
I think we'll leave, we'll leave it at that,
yes. It's been fun to go over all of this.
Yeah, thanks so much. And we'll definitely make sure to, well, we'll definitely keep in touch on the progress of the project if it isn't eclipsed by apocalypse itself or completely overrun by
No, I don't think so. This is a slow motion disaster. It's not going to happen immediately, although it's happening already. You know, and we don't even know what's happening. That's the other thing. We don't quite understand. You know, why is the economy not rebounding? You know? There are different views. The austerity people are on the ascendant at the moment. That's not making things better. The stimulus people, no, the information just came out of how much the Fed has given to the banks, $16 trillion. Yeah. You know, can you imagine that? All the conventions of the limits of government action have been shattered by this crisis. In fact, government itself has probably been shattered in the crisis. So we're on completely new terrain. Mm-hmm. Now, this is 1914 or 1939 or something like that. Yeah. This is where the historical turning point of frightening dimensions.
Thanks for tuning in to The Historical Gadfly. Again, I'm your host, Timothy Noonan of the University of Oxford. If you have any questions, suggestions, or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch with us at historicalgadfly@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.